1994, James Bird Jr. accepted a lift home. He had been sitting on his parents' porch, bouncing his granddaughter on his knee. Soon, the world would come to know him as the victim of an unspeakable hate crime. This is the lynching of James Bird Jr. Hi and welcome to Nightmare Somewhere. This is episode 6. It is on the 1998 murder of James Bird Jr., a black man who was tortured and defiled in a hate crime that changed the law. I'd like to make it clear that I will not be explaining his death as far as detailed by the pathologist, but the following does contain very distressing content. Please be aware that it is not intended for all listeners. The word lynching describes an act of mob violence that is racially motivated. A mob has the definition of three or more people. Historically, they have included hanging, burning, and torture. There is no effort on behalf of the perpetrators to hide their crime. They want people to know that there has been an attack, and they want the public, particularly those of the same race, to feel fear. It is certainly a method of intimidation and social control. Members of the mob tend to celebrate afterwards. These are evident in the murder of James Bird Jr. James was born in 1949 in Beaumont, Texas. He was the third born child in a deeply religious family. His father, whose name was James Sr., was a deacon for the Greater New Bethel Baptist Church, and his mother, Stella May, was a Sunday school teacher there. His family explained how he was naturally gifted academically and musically, but chose not to go to college. He was in the last segregated class to graduate from the local high school, and he got married not long afterwards. James began his life as a family man, marrying in 1970. He and his wife went on to have three children, two daughters and one son. After 23 years of marriage, he and his wife divorced, and James began somewhat of a downward spiral, drinking too much, and he was sent to prison briefly for theft and forgery. He had been a vacuum machine salesman earlier in life, but at the time of the crime, he was on disability payments because he suffered from a seizure disorder. He had recently reconnected with his son, Ross. So James had missed some of the years when his children were younger, as they had moved to another town with their mum after the divorce. James had recently become a grandfather too, when his eldest child, daughter Renee, had a daughter of her own. Mary Verrett is one of James's many sisters. She shared a bit of a memory of her brother, and this is a quote. "He loved people. He was very people orientated, as a matter of fact. He was the kind of person who never wanted to be alone. He would walk up to a group and join right in. He was very intelligent. People in the family would tell him he never used his full intellect. I would get upset with him at times, like everyone else did. He had his faults, but the most harm he ever did was to his own self. He was never the kind to harm others." Jasper, Texas is a remote logging town close to the Louisiana border. It is part of the Big Pine Belt, And I will admit that I don't know exactly what that means, but as most of my listeners are from the US, I probably shouldn't have admitted that. And the economy is fueled by the timber and bass fishing trades. The population sits at around 8,500, and it is close to even amounts of whites and black residents, although blacks do have a bit of a minority at around 45%. So these are the events that took place in the early hours of June 7th in 1998. James had been at his niece's anniversary party, and this was held at his parents' house. He left at around 1:30 a.m. to walk home. He would be seen walking around the town from time to time, as his seizure disorder restricted him from driving. James had been drinking and was, by most accounts, fairly intoxicated at this point. While walking home, he was offered a lift from three men: John William King, Lawrence Brewer, and Sean Berry. James accepted the offer and recognised Sean Berry. So Sean Berry was a bit of a familiar face in town. He was the manager of the local cinema, and it is reported one or two places that Sean Berry had given him a lift in the past. Sean Berry was driving. It was his car. It was a grey Ford pickup truck. James sat in the back tray of the truck, and the three men were in the front. At some point, the men turned off the road, away from the direction leading to where James lived. They stopped at a remote area of town where they supposedly offered James a drink. He was then bashed, urinated on, and he had his face sprayed with black spray paint. After this, using logging chain, James was tied by his ankles to the back of the truck and dragged for close to 3 miles along a grainy bitumen road. James was alive for much of this and had been attempting to protect his head from hitting the road. He died after his body hit an exposed culvert, which is a pipeline that runs under the road. It was at this time that his head and arm was severed. The men kept travelling for some distance until they detached his remains and left them at the gate of a church, which was also the premises of a black cemetery. It was a Sunday, and people were arriving for church service that morning. Thanks for that, and I do apologise. So, I have read countless articles on this case, dating from the time of the crime up to the present day, and I do have to say that this isn't mentioned in the majority of them, but several articles do claim that the three men then went to a barbecue in the following hours after the crime. Billy Rolls, though, who was the Jasper City Sheriff, you'll be hearing a bit more about him later. So he led the investigation, and he stated that the men in fact went home to bed. So I'll put my money on that, and not only because the media reports are bollocks. So a hallmark of lynchings are that they celebrate afterwards, typically with a barbecue or picnic. So I'm thinking that it was fabricated, which would be so disappointing because the events are beyond horrifying. You do not need to embellish. James Byrd Jr.'s funeral was held at the family's church. It was at capacity, so that was 200, which left hundreds of others to mourn outdoors. Basketball player Dennis Rodman offered to pay for the funeral, which was held close to a week after his death. Over the course of this week, the Bird family set the tone for how those in the town would respond. So they were hurting, and they didn't want that hurt to spread. They were encouraging healing and unity, and that message was reaffirmed at James's funeral, with mourners being urged to not choose retaliation. Coming up are details of the investigation and the collection of evidence. It does include graphic content. So I mentioned Sheriff Billy Rowles. I hope that's how you pronounce it. Rowles. R-O-W-L-E-S. It shouldn't be that hard to pronounce. Rowles. He explained how he got a call that Sunday morning of a body being found on Huff Creek Road and tire tracks down the pavement. This is a quote from Sheriff Rowles. "I remember thinking this was going to be the easiest hit and run we'd ever worked. We would just follow the skid marks all the way to the guy's house. So I went out there and started to follow the trail. There were some dentures lying in the road. And further down, there were keys and some loose change. Well, I kept walking and I got to looking closer at the skid marks and I saw that they weren't tire tracks at all. It was a trail of dried blood. I followed it for almost 3 miles. So when investigators followed the blood trail, as just described by the sheriff, though they were to find body parts in close to 80 different spots along the quite remote road. And this led them to a field. It was fairly evident that something had taken place there. In addition to some unopened beer bottles, there was a compact disc, a pair of shoes, the wallet belonging to James. They found cigarette butts, a button from James's shirt, as well as his baseball cap, a wrench inscribed with the name Berry, and a lighter which had the word possum engraved on it. And the lighter was also inscribed with the letters KKK. A witness came forward and made a statement to police of how he was driving that night and saw James walking along the road. Later, he saw James in the back of a grey pickup truck. There were also two or three white men in the front. Between the wrench inscribed with Berry and how one of the investigators recalled that Sean Berry drove a vehicle matching this witness statement, they were ready to act. So the next day, police stopped Berry for a traffic violation. So that seems really coincidental to me. I began thinking that maybe they stopped him because of the vehicle. Whatever they're thinking, it was extremely fortunate that they did. They found a set of tools matching the wrench found at the crime scene, blood splatters beneath the vehicle, and a rust stain that was in the distinct outline of a chain. The blood was tested and it matched Mr. Bird's, and the tyres on the truck matched the tracks that were at the clearing. Not only that, the cigarette butts were tested and the DNA came back as a match for John William King, and the lighter with the word possum engraved belonged to him as well. Possum had been his name while he was in prison. So the minute that local authorities knew for sure that it was looking very much like a hate crime, they contacted the FBI. Sheriff Rowles would say, "I knew we were going to need all the help we could get." I'll be back with a bit of background on the ringleader, John William King, and the trials and sentences for each of the offenders. John King was adopted at 3 months old. His family originally lived in Mississippi before moving to Texas before he started school. So he had mum, dad, and two sisters. His father, whose name is Ronald King, would later explain that it was a loving household. Ronald was disgraced by his son's crime and would go on to continually apologize to the Byrd family. They accepted these and acknowledged that he did not raise a killer. In a letter to James's family, Ronald wrote, "It hurts me deeply that a boy I raised and considered to be the most loved boy I knew could find in himself to take a life." Ronald had been a plywood mill worker before he retired, and John's mother had died years before the crime. Suffering emphysema, he attended John's trial in a wheelchair, carrying a bottle of oxygen. He avoided the media outside the courthouse for much of the trial, but did comment that the man in that courtroom was not the boy he knew. He spoke of how his son had grown up with black friends, including Ronald's two goddaughters. He was at a loss. So John King was a high school dropout who didn't have the best history of holding down a job. He did have a son with a girlfriend at some point, but I didn't see anything else written on that. The following has been used as somewhat of a catalyst for how John King could have been so filled with hate and rage. So the town of Jasper was completely floored by the crime, and they were looking for some understanding and some answers as to how an atrocity like this could happen. So the following comes from a Washington Post article. First trial opens in dragging death. At the age of 17, both King and co-offender Berry, so they had been schoolmates, I believe. They had been friends for quite a while. So they were caught during a burglary. It was the second arrest for burglary for King. It was at a vending machine company. One of the co-workers hid inside after the place closed and let King and Berry in. The three of them had drank some beers and were about to walk out with some pool cues when the police arrived. King and Berry were both sentenced to a correctional boot camp for a few months before being released. King kept breaching the rules of his probation, though. A judge revoked the probation from his first burglary and gave him an 8-year prison term. At 20 years old, he landed in the maximum security George Beto unit, which is a 3,400 inmate penitentiary. The prison understandably doesn't share information too readily, but an interview was conducted on some of the prisoners of the low security unit. One of the questions they were asked was, "What has been the worst thing that has happened to you in prison?" And these are some of their responses. Being raped repeatedly by guards. Being in a riot where people were stabbed to death. One prisoner answered that being away from family was the worst thing, but the interview goes on to explain that his girlfriend had been sexually violated by both guards and prisoners, and it was the guard who instigated it. Another answer was, "Hating myself so bad, I won't look in the mirror." So John King shared a cell with Lawrence Brewer, who would be his co-offender. Brewer was somewhat of a veteran of prison life by this stage. He had been in prison before, and this time he was in prison for cocaine charges, theft, and probation violations. The article goes on to explain that alliances founded on race are a fact of life in prison, and authorities said that King and Brewer got involved in one such group, a group of inmates using the name of the North Carolina-based Ku Klux Klan faction, the Confederate Knights of America. By the time King was paroled in 1997, there was no mistaking how he felt about the supremacy of the white man. His attorney, along with the prison fellowship, would explain too, much later on, how white power groups in prison had conspired with prison guards to put King in the black section of the jail where he was gang raped. From there, King was easily recruited into their group for protection. 2 years of indoctrination followed, as this was just at the beginning of his sentence. When King was brought in for questioning, the first thing that investigators noticed were his tattoos. These were explained and described in loads of articles, and they were a black man hanging from a tree, a swastika, the patch for the Confederate Knights of America, the words Aryan Pride on his torso, and a woodpecker in a KKK outfit making an obscene gesture. He refused to cooperate and insisted that he was home in bed. He suggested that Brewer and Berry must have headed out attempting to score some drugs, and it turned sour and those two carried out the murder. This was a little bit cunning of King, because by suggesting that it was a drug deal gone bad, was By saying it was a drug deal gone bad was to say that it was not a hate crime at all. And if that was the case, the offenders would not be facing potential death sentences. Not that investigators fell for any of that shit anyway. They didn't need a confession. With the statements from Berry and the evidence, they had enough to head to trial. So John King was the first of the three to stand trial. He attended court in a bulletproof vest and strapped to a 50,000 volt stun belt. The courthouse had been fitted with metal detectors, scanners, and security cameras. The jury was made up of 7 men, including one who was black, and 5 women. So there was 11 jurors who were white and one who was black. They were told of how King wanted to form a white supremacy group in the town of Jasper, a local group fashioned after the Confederate Knights of America, and King felt as though they needed to do something dramatic to attract media attention. So while he will never confess, a note was intercepted that King had written to co-accused Brewer, which read, "Seriously though, bro, regardless of the outcome of this, we have made history and shall die proudly remembered if need be. Much Aryan love." King showed no remorse and no emotion at all, really. I don't want to go into the trial all that much. I feel as though I've spent enough time talking about John King. The jury elected the only black person to be the foreperson to announce the verdict. He was found guilty and sentenced to death. It was the first case in 150 years where a white man was given the death sentence for killing a black man in the state of Texas. After many appeals and over 20 years, King was put to death by a lethal injection in April of last year. The execution was witnessed by some of James's family, including his sister Clara, who remarked, "T Today, we witness the peaceful and dignified execution of John King for the savage, brutal, and inhumane murder of James on June 7, 1998. Sean Berry was given life in prison as he had cooperated with investigators and had given statements early on. Also, it is generally accepted that he did not have such a background of being involved with white supremacy groups, and he very possibly played a smaller role in the murder. He will be eligible for parole in 2038. He is currently housed in the protected part of the prison, where he spends 23 hours a day in his cell. He has 1 hour of recreation. In the years following the murder, Berry wrote a letter to James's 3 children, and then he sat down with James's son, Ross, to share what happened that night, as far as he saw it. So afterwards, Ross would say how he wanted to believe Berry and that he did seem sincere, but a lot of what Berry said did not add up with the known facts. Lawrence Brewer was found guilty and given the death sentence too, and his execution was carried out a lot earlier than the execution for King. So Brewer was executed in 2011. I read an interesting article. Very, very interesting, actually. So, it was about how Brewer's execution was scheduled for the same night as the execution of Troy Davis, who was a black man who had been convicted of killing a white off-duty police officer in Georgia in 1989. The article had been written before the executions, so there was still room for a potential pardon or clemency, but those executions did in fact go forward, and that was on the 21st of September 2011. So not much is written on Brewer, which is awesome, but one thing he is known for is his last meal before his execution. So he asked for 2 chicken fried steaks with gravy and sliced onions, a triple patty bacon cheeseburger, a cheese omelette with ground beef, tomatoes, onions, bell peppers and jalapenos, a bowl of fried okra with ketchup, 1 pound of barbecue meat with half a loaf of bread, 3 fajitas, a meat lover's pizza, 1 pint of Bluebell ice cream, a slab of peanut butter fudge with crushed peanuts, and 3 root beers. He then said he was no longer hungry and didn't eat any of it. The next day, movements were launched by state legislators to end this 87-year tradition of giving a condemned person a last meal of their choice. And indeed, this is no longer a practice. The day before his execution, Brewer told a radio station, "As far as any regrets, no, I have no regrets. No, I'll do it all over again, to tell you the truth." So, hell must have had a real homecoming for that one. All right, so I'm going to be back in a moment with some closing comments and the legacy for James Byrd Jr. Thanks. James's sister Mary shared how her brother always said, "When I leave this earth, the earth will know that James Byrd Jr. has been here." And that is true for more reasons than just his murder. Soon after the event, his family established the Byrd Foundation for Racial Healing. Luvon Byrd Harris explained how the foundation is used for education. In fact, their motto is "Stop the Hate, Educate." They offer training workshops, school visits, and community programs. Another mission of theirs is to keep James's memory alive and raise awareness of what happened in 1998. The foundation aims to break down barriers, which sort of leads me to another response to his murder. It was the wrought iron fence that separated the graves of the black and white people in the Jasper City Cemetery. This fence was torn down after separating the two areas for 161 years. The town of Jasper went on to build the James Byrd Jr. Memorial Park and has claimed that rather than igniting discord, the crime united the people of the town. The killing has had lasting effects on the town, which overnight found itself as some symbol of hate, racism, and fear. With a population almost evenly divided between blacks and whites, the town had been doing well for itself before the event. I will leave some links so you can read further about that. Another legacy of James Byrd Jr. is a piece of legislation that was signed in 2009 by then President Barack Obama. It is called the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crime Prevention Act. Matthew Shepard was a 21-year-old gay student from Wyoming. He, like James, was a victim of a hate crime, and the similarities don't stop there. Matthew, too, had accepted a lift home, but was taken to an isolated field where he was tortured and bashed. He was left there tied to a fence. He was discovered in the morning by a cyclist who mistook him for a scarecrow. He died 6 days later from his injuries. The crimes occurred just months apart. At the time of James's murder, there were no hate crime laws in Texas. The Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crime Prevention Act broadens the scope of how victims will be protected. It also added the protection to homosexuals who are the victims of hate crime, and it allows for federal authorities to investigate cases that local authorities don't pursue. The Act provides funding so that these crimes can be both investigated and prosecuted. James's family believe the legislation will deter hate crimes from happening in the future. Luvon Bird Harris explains that the Act can let people feel a little bit safer because criminals will have to think long and hard about their actions because they will pay dearly for them, perhaps with their lives. I'll close with something I read during the research, which does offer a positive spin to the crime. John William King sought to terrorize blacks in East Texas by murdering James Byrd Jr., but his vicious crime instead provided federal law enforcement with additional tools to punish perpetrators of hate crimes. That is it from me for the time being. Please have a read of some of the links. I understand that it is because of how back in 1998, you know, the internet wasn't so popular for people reading news reports. We used to get the newspaper. But if you search for information on James Byrd Jr., you will get pages and pages of articles on his killers. So I've tried to weed out the surplus of these ones, the ones that deal primarily with the executions. There are some fascinating articles on how the town of Jasper recovered from the fallout from the crime, although I shouldn't use the past tense. It is a town still recovering. James's sister Luvon still runs the Bird Foundation for Racial Healing. I'll include the link to their site in the show notes. Thanks again, take care. I'll see you later. Bye.